Definitely a change of subject. We're also talking about fronts, but they're very different fronts. They're fronts on a larger horizontal scale. They're in the ocean, although, I mean, that wouldn't have to matter. The ocean has stable boundary layers too, but that's not what we're talking about. And we're talking about fronts in which the rotational influence, planetary rotation, is very important, where it was completely irrelevant in what Peter showed. And fronts in which, in some sense, the controlling information is in the buoyancy field. The buoyancy field is not the byblow of, you know, the shear-generated vortices. Rather, the velocity structure is largely controlled by the buoyancy field. And in the buoyancy field, you see strong horizontal gradients, and those are the fronts. Now, submesoscale is now a big topic. Largely unknown a little more than a decade ago. I'm not going to really tell you about the submesoscale. That would be a different talk. It's actually the one the organizers wanted me to give. Rather, I'm just going to do it with a couple of pictures. And here, a satellite image of false color plankton concentration. And you see that the submesoscale is really just a bunch of lines on the sea. Now, in this particular case, there's an organizing vortex in the center. It's still very small, sort of diameter a kilometer or two. So it's definitely not mesoscale. And those lines are there because there are buoyant surfactant materials that get gathered into horizontal convergence lines above downwelling centers. The phenomenon is very broadband in spatial scale, sort of 100 meters in horizontal width to about 10 kilometers. Here's another example, a historical example that was taken by, you know, a Brownie camera or something by an astronaut with nothing else to do riding around in a projectile, called Spirals on the Sea. The spirals you see are, again, surfactants, convergence lines. That is, they are fronts. And fronts and convergence lines, is one of the messages here, are essentially synonymous. And this talk is to be about, mainly about frontogenesis, the thing that is making the fronts. Now, this is a scale range that is also occupied by inertial gravity waves. There are some level of interactions, but rather minor. That's a different subject. I'm not going to talk about it. There's another population of submesoscale vortical flows generated by interactions of flow with topography near the bottom. Of course, the bottom rises to the top in the ocean, so it's a big population. That's a different subject I'm not going to talk about today. Now, there's here's another sort of level of description, essentially from a dynamical perspective. There are horizontal density gradients. Along the axis of these gradients are jets. The first thought about jets is they're geostrophic because of the density gradients. But then there are overturning circulations in the cross-frontal plane, and those essentially are the frontogenetic agents. The structure is created by the frontogenesis process. The energy process, the source is available potential energy, and so all of this is going on in the situation of vertical buoyancy flux, which is restratifying flux, and there are different ways that you can release that energy and energize the submesoscale. Occasionally the lines, I mean, they deform, they sometimes tear up, in that tearing up, they can roll up into coherent vortices, and you saw some of the vortices in the previous picture. This is a dynamics in which rotation, stratification, and vertical shear numbers are all sort of order one. That is, this is not quasi-geostrophic thinking of valid on larger scales, and it's not sort of microscopic, forget rotation on smaller scales, as in the middle of Pete's boundary layer. Now, let me in a couple of cartoons, two cartoons that look a lot alike except for one difference of structure, sketch what is kind of the classical conception of phronogenesis, which comes to us from meteorology, starting with the Norwegian school in Bergeron, mathematized by Hoskins and Bretherton. And the idea is that you have a horizontal density gradient along a line, and if it's in the presence of those dash dot line confluent flows, then you will create a phronogenesis in which that line will continue to sharpen. And under those circumstances, you will develop a secondary circulation, the dark arrows on the side. And in the case of a front, you'll have upward flow on the light side, downward flow on the heavy side. You'll generate anticyclonic vorticity by vortex compression on the right side and cyclonic on the dense side. And there's an addition, an along frontal flow that is at least partially geostrophic. The whole thing is surface intensified. What makes it surface intensified and substantially surface confined in the ocean is the fact that you have a weakly stratified layer associated with boundary layer turbulence above a much more strongly stratified layer in the oceanic pycnocline. And that sort of flow will definitely sharpen, undergo phronogenesis. That's a front. Its companion is a filament in which it's not a step in surface density, but rather it's a minimum in surface density, a heavy center. And all the same ingredients are there, except the flow structure is a bit different. If you look in particular in the cross-frontal plane, you see it's this sort of two-celled circulation with very strong downwelling and cyclonic vorticity generation in the center. This is a much more efficient configuration for phronogenesis to operate than in a comparable front. What we see in observations and in sort of realistic simulations is a combination of fronts and filaments. Now, that classical picture is the sort of strain theory of phronogenesis. But let's talk also about the role of convergence. If you have an external velocity field and a passive scalar, and in particular density could be viewed at some incipient scale of phronogenesis as a passive scalar, then that flow implies an exponential growth of the strength of the gradient. But once you develop the local secondary circulation, convergence implies super exponential growth, and in some balance models that even leads to finite time singularity as a prediction. The oceanic mesoscale and the atmospheric synoptic scale, the synoptic scale where this sort of idea arose, have stronger strain and convergence because they have small Rossby number. And so for this reason, the meteorologists essentially gave attention more to confluence as the mechanism. And besides, kind of any idiot would think that convergence would be phronogenetic, so they wanted some better story, and that was their better story. The oceanic submesoscale fronts have both comparable in strain and convergence on the scale of the front itself because the Rossby number is not small. And that distinction between whether you're small Rossby number phronogenesis or large Rossby number phronogenesis is an important one. Now, that whole discussion of strain phronogenesis completely ignored small-scale turbulence. A defining feature of the surface boundary layer, atmosphere, or ocean is boundary layer turbulence, in particular vertical momentum mixing. And under those conditions, in realistic simulations, the prevailing momentum balance is approximately as indicated here. It's come to be called turbulent thermal wind. And the ingredients are vertical mixing in the horizontal momentum equation, Coriolis force, and a pressure gradient force that is essentially carried by the buoyancy if this is a surface-concentrated circulation, and buoyancy anomaly, and then three-dimensional incompressibility. And so if you have a very simple situation, as indicated here, of uniform geostrophic vertical shear in the boundary layer, then and just assume constant shear, constant eddy viscosity, so kind of a classical Ekman layer-like calculation, then that in that balance, you will have an agiostrophic flow whose profiles u in the direction of across the shear, v in the direction of the shear, that are opposing. And if Rossby number's not small, that is, we're comparing these numbers to 1, then these are not small. And so these are strong agiostrophic circulations. Now imagine you have that flow at each point horizontally in a density field whose horizontal structure is a front or a filament. That implies convergent flow. And so turbulent thermal wind is frontogenetic. And there's no external strain here. And if you have a buoyancy field that is either a front or a filament, as you see in the top row, then you will have secondary circulations in the cross-frontal plane, as shown here, either one cell or two cells. And these secondary circulations are talking about the agiostrophic flow. And in the case of the front, there is downwelling on the dense side. And in the case of the filament, there's strong downwelling in the center, where the tail of that arrow is. And in the center there are strong surface convergence lines. And those are the places where the frontogenesis will continue to act. Now, one way to sort of make sense of this is to go beyond that simple picture of that simple momentum balance and essentially make a balanced model of the general Boussinesq equations. Under these circumstances, the balance assumption is neglected agiostrophic accelerations. Essentially, all balance models have historically neglected agiostrophic accelerations, even if they don't neglect total accelerations, including geostrophic. And so essentially the idea is, given a buoyancy field and a characterization of the surface fluxes and vertical mixing by eddy viscosities, then calculate what the secondary circulation is, which is u here, and the frontogenetic tendencies, which, following the meteorological frontogenetic literature, is defined as the Lagrangian time derivative of the variance, the square of the horizontal buoyancy gradient or the horizontal velocity gradient. And this can then be diagnosed for a given set of buoyancy and mixing situations. It's in the spirit of a Sawyer-Eliasson equation, which has long been a tool in the atmospheric literature. It's a somewhat more general formulation, and it's definitely focused on, in this use, the particular question of submesoscale circulation and frontogenesis. Now, it can fail to exist, as in all balanced approximations, as if the Rossby number is large enough. On the other hand, again, in relying on realistic simulations, circulations like this do continue to exist even at large Rossby number, and so the thought is that they are more complete solutions to Navier-Stokes equations, but they stay close to this class of solutions, whatever their necessary discrepancies are. And we're going to talk about, as I've been talking about so far, sort of idealized 2D situations. And so here's an example, just to give you a feel for it, of an SCFT solution, that kind of diagnostic analysis. On the left, this is the vertical velocity in a filament configuration. On the left is essentially that linear momentum balance in a case without wind. And so you get this central downwelling, peripheral upwelling that is the two-celled secondary circulation that I've been describing. But now if you take a somewhat more complete view, Rossby number order 1 include the nonlinear advection in buoyancy and momentum, include the wind forcing, pick a particular direction for the wind. These solutions are quite sensitive to direction. This one happens to be sort of at a 45 degree angle across the filament. Then you get a similar but different structure. It's about 3 times stronger. It's much narrower and more concentrated. And so these finite Rossby number, finite advections, adiastrophic advection effects matter, but they matter in a quantitative way, not a qualitative way. And both of these imply strong convergence at the surface, and so both are strongly phronogenetic. Now, I like the word toy model. Let's make a reduced model of what seems to be going on here. And this first slide is really just a reminder of the scaling that Hoskins and Bretherton did to get semi-geostrophy. And in the usual way, there are length scales that are different across and along fronts, a depth scale, and a cross-front velocity that scales as epsilon times the along front velocity, where epsilon is the anisotropy parameter, and it's very small. And the Rossby number in this context can go to order 1, but the time scaling here is also based on this strong anisotropy. And that is a framework within which strain-induced phronogenesis was analyzed and solutions were produced. I, of course, don't need to say that it's the elder Bretherton that I'm talking about here. If you take a slightly different point of view, again, motivated by what's seen in the observations of realistic solutions, where the only change you make is you essentially say the Rossby number is the ordering parameter rather than the anisotropy, again, possibly order 1, but keeping the anisotropy strong, then what you get is that if you do sort of a leading order scaling analysis in the phronogenetic tendencies, velocity, and buoyancy gradient, then you get something that has a rate factor minus delta. Delta is the horizontal convergence, divergence, and so minus delta is the convergence. And so it looks essentially like exponential growth. You can turn it into scaling rates just by normalizing phronogenetic rates by normalizing it, and you get the minus delta. But delta is not something imposed by external flow. Delta is an internal parameter in the flow. And so building on that, you can then write Lagrangian evolution equations for the vorticity and the divergence. You get all the things that you might imagine happening. Here are the leading order terms with these convergent rate terms. If you talk about Coriolis and vertical mixing, they might come in sort of at a next order, but they're also in this TTW situation continuing to essentially cancel even as the front gets strong. And so you're really left with sort of vertical advection, horizontal diffusion, and they're typically small compared to this driving term. That gives you a reduced model for the rate of change of the convergence and the vorticity, that is velocity gradients, gives you finite time singularity as you approach some singular time, sort of no free parameters in the convergence fit. And if you go to the divergence equation evolution, if you go to the buoyancy evolution, again, this sort of rate controlling parameter, and so it's a weaker singularity, but still singular. Now, this doesn't assume small Rossby number. It's finite time singular. Something will go wrong, or else you would have to award me the Clay Prize. And what essentially goes wrong in most numerical models that pursue phronogenesis with no special attention is your horizontal diffusion begins to arrest the front, and that stops it. And how dull, but what's that horizontal diffusion? What happens in sort of the realistic solutions with high resolution is you start to see frontal fragmentation, frontal instability. You lose the anisotropy of horizontal scales, and there's then the possibility that that frontal instability can provide an arrest mechanism and interfere with this model. Now, I work with a model called ROMS, Regional Ocean Modeling System. upper left is a snapshot of the surface divergence field instantaneously in a simulation of the Gulf of Mexico. You see again a bunch of lines. You often see those lines paired. There's plenty of plus and minus. But the skewness of this is negative. That is, it's a convergence-dominated flow. That is, a frontogenesis-dominated flow. And going into this flow and identifying events of amplifying convergence, amplifying frontogenesis, and compositing those events over 656 in this case, you get these composite curves of the evolution of the divergence, negative, compared to, this is the composite result compared to the theory that I just showed. They seem to follow very close together. At the end in the model with its finite resolution, it's beginning to drop off. And here is the same thing for the horizontal buoyancy gradient. And so this does seem to be a good characterization of how frontogenesis is working. And the important thing is that once your Rossby number is small, frontogenesis is essentially always controlled by convergence and secondary circulation, not by a larger scale background strain field, although that may have worked to initiate it. Switching subjects, in a little bit of trouble with time. I now want to talk about some LES solutions. They're done with Peter. They're massive. He can tell you how massive. And here's a case in which, with nudging of the temperature field, a fully developed turbulence field developed. And then the nudging of the temperature field was turned off, and it was a free evolution. And what you're seeing in the left are along front averaged, this is a filament case, fields, temperature at the top, a long front flow at the bottom, cross front flow third, and vertical velocity bottom. There's a little bit of noise here because the along front average for such a delicate quantity is a bit noisy because the turbulent W's are so much bigger, but it looks just like the cartoon that I sketched, and that's what it looks like 6 hours later. Still more or less the same morphology, but look how sharp the front is. It's essentially, you know, infinitesimal on this scale. And so here's a case of TTW-induced frontogenesis. Here are time series of the peak vertical vorticity, peak vertical velocity, peak turbulent kinetic energy, that is, removing the along front average fields. And they all amplify enormously till they come to an arrest event, and then there's a prolonged decay event. Here are snapshots at the time of peak vorticity, along front direction, cross front direction, the fluctuating UV product, and W. It's all small scale turbulence. You can see somewhat larger scales in V. You see this very clear negative Reynolds stress, and that's the arresting process. That is, this is a horizontal shear instability. That then arrests the frontogenesis. And both continue, both the frontogenesis by the secondary circulation and the resistance by the turbulent Reynolds stress through the strong slow decay period. Here's a turbulent kinetic energy spectrum at a couple of different depths. The total kinetic energy, just the vertical component, in the along front direction near the time of peak arrest. Peter draws a minus 5/3 line, it must be turbulence. But the boundary layer scale is essentially here. And so there is energy on the submesoscale, and there's essentially a continuous cascade of energy down to finer scales. This is a slide I won't linger over. This is several different cases, same sort of time series, wind in different directions. No wind, just convective forcing to maintain the turbulence. You see the same kind of events in all cases, but of course the details matter as you talk about wind direction or not and the like. But the mechanism is essentially the same. And so the last topic I want to talk about is how does this change when you have surface gravity waves. Here's one way to write the wave averaged equations in which everything on the right hand side are extra terms that appear due to the wave averaging. And the way I'm writing it here, they're all related either to Stokes drift or some additional parameterized mixing you would have because of the wave turbulent interaction. I'm not going to talk about the parameterized F and Q. And so in that framework of the starting equation, instead of the usual Boussinesq equations, you can go through the same kind of SCFT, ROMS, LES, etc. You essentially come out with it's generally similar phenomenology, but there are some differences. And here, for example, is a comparison on the right with what I showed you before, namely the nonlinear SCFT diagnostic vertical velocity without waves, on the left with waves, and down below a difference. They're similar but different. The quantitative differences are almost as large as the signal, and yet it doesn't turn night into day. Here, associated with the same two solutions are the velocity phrenogenetic tendencies, and you see in line with those strong downwelling W's the strong positive tendency for velocity gradient growth in both cases. In this case, it's a little bit stronger with the wind stress, with the waves. And this is for a northeast directed wind. Here are a set of LES solutions, again in time series. Here just talking about peak vorticity, but that's kind of a surrogate for everything else going on in the front. And you see essentially three different base cases, either N for north wind, C for pure convection, and then additions of waves or not, and those waves are either in the cross front direction, east-west, or the along front direction, north-south. And what you see in this particular scatter of plots is that with north waves, never mind whether there's north wind or not, you get a strong suppression of the phrenogenesis. It still happens, but it happens much more weakly. On the other hand, when the waves are in a different orientation, there's essentially no suppression. So why is it so much weaker in this case of north waves? You can go into those wave averaged equations, identify a particular term associated with the vortex force or the Stokes shear force, either way, and it gives you an advection of velocity across the front. And what you then see at some time after the peak front, or just around peak phrenogenesis that has been diminished by the action of the waves, is your vertical velocity field, which was this single downwelling jet, has become two pieces. That is, you've fragmented the front and the vertical. You've moved the frontal gradient and buoyancy away from the main frontal gradient throughout the depth of the filament. You've created two fronts. Those two fronts then start in their secondary circulation and phrenogenesis to interfere with each other. And if you look at the associated velocity fields, because this is with waves, therefore it's Langmuir turbulence, therefore everybody wants to see Langmuir cells. Yeah, there are Langmuir cells everywhere, but they're highly heterogeneous. They're clearly strongly influenced and modified by where they are in this frontal structure. So, I said all this. Phrenogenesis is a key process in submesoscale dynamics. It's a key process in atmospheric surface fronts as well, which also has its TTW versions as well as the historical strain-induced versions. in realistic simulations with ROMs, I've showed you one picture. It is the TTW secondary circulation that dominates more often over the strain-induced one. You can diagnose secondary circulation in front of genetic tendency, and its surface convergence rate, negative W, that really matters for the rate at which things are sharpening. Once the front is strong enough, once the Rossby number is no longer small, in a sense, all fronts become universal in their frontogenesis when you get to that stage. Frontal instabilities do the rest. That's probably a generally true perspective. Not necessarily always this horizontal shear instability. One can easily imagine changing various shapes of the fronts and getting different arresting instabilities. And this is what sets the lower limit for the size of the submesoscale in the ocean. This is where, you know, fronts end and boundary layer turbulence takes over, except that boundary layer turbulence itself is going to be very heavily modified by the existence of these fronts in a way that, from a theoretical boundary layer perspective, built upon years of experiments in Kansas and horizontally homogeneous LASs, we really don't have a clue about what kind of small-scale turbulence this is. Frontal decay is slower than frontogenesis, but again, sort of days. Surface wave Stokes drift matters. It matters as much as the rest of the secondary circulation matters. It can modify it. And I think once you open up the question of, you know, wind-driven currents, submesoscale currents, surface waves affects boundary layers, there are probably many different kind of phenomena that can arise. And we really have no overview of that yet. We, you know, particularly when you get down to the arrest and boundary layer interaction scale, we have, at the moment, only a few examples. Thank you.
So I had a question about parameter dependence. So when you add the Stokes drift, and you saw that when the waves were going along the front, you disrupted the secondary circulation dramatically. So, and you interpret that in terms of vortex dynamics, the vorticity of the in the long front direction, right? So that the Stokes drift generates a Stokes vortex force.
You interpret it in terms of modifying the secondary circulation.
Right, but it, you have vertical vorticity, and you have Stokes shear that tilts over that vorticity, and then that affects the secondary circulation. So that's competing with the baroclinic torque. So clearly there must be some dependence on the strength of the front versus the strength of the Stokes shear, the strength of the vorticity. So in some regimes, the Stokes shear won't be important. Other regimes, it will. So have you...
Yes.
Okay. All right.
I will make one remark that there at this point has, you know, a fairly substantial literature, some of which is Leaf's, of people looking at frontal dynamics and secondary circulations and that sort of thing in numerical simulations. What I think is somewhat different about our perspective on the frontal arrest problem is that we have fully developed turbulence, and often in those cases the turbulence was much weaker or was only growing slowly after certain other submesoscale things had happened. But it all fits in the category that there are undoubtedly regimes of outcomes, many yet to be discovered.
So as I understand it, then the boundary layer structure and sort of turbulent mixing in the boundary layer is important to all of this. How hard is it to parameterize the boundary layer for a model like this of submesoscale flow? I mean, for instance, things like even deciding how deep it is.
In the, essentially, the ocean circulation models with parameterized mixing, ROMs in our case, other models in other cases, the boundary layer mixing was always parameterized and the phenomenology emerged. And that was essentially the guidance. Now, parameterize it accurately, parameterize it at the moment of frontal arrest, maybe not. but the whole sort of developing sequence of an emerging field of, you know, lines on the surface. It even simple boundary layer mixing ideas seem to work fairly well.
May I ask about the arrest mechanism? So if I understand rightly, your asymmetry parameter is shrinking over time because of the secondary circulation. So the delta over which the shear happens is shrinking, but the along front remains the same. So at some point, this horizontal shear instability, like a mixing layer instability, takes over. And I'm puzzled that it's a depth scale, HBL, that seems to set that horizontal scale. Are you able to describe why that might be?
Well, no, I don't need that. Roughly speaking, the fronts most of the time are weak stratification layer filling. And therefore, the instability that arrests the frontogenesis, and that structure more or less persists as the frontogenesis progresses. And that structure itself is sort of naturally unstable to horizontal shear instability on that vertical scale, because that's the vertical scale of the parent circulation. And it is the along front froze horizontal gradient that is the flow instability source in an energetic sense. Now, what we're seeing here, which we've seen in some other idealized problems before, is that if you take a frontal configuration and analyze its instability, even an evolving frontal configuration that is phenogenetically sharpening, as if by the strain mechanism, that the growth rate of the instability climbs more steeply with shrinking horizontal scale than does the shrinking horizontal scale itself. And so at some point it overtakes it. In this case, it's overtaking it with a depth, with a horizontal scale that is like the depth scale of the structure.
That's the mystery. Why is it?
I mean, well, I don't think it's a mystery given the flow structure that's there. The question is, what other flow structures could be there if one posed the problem somewhat differently, and you know, different stratification, different boundary layer depth, different velocity profile, etc. Hi, George.
Can you comment a little bit about, is there a role for submesoscales in large scale ocean circulation?
Absolutely.
And what, in terms of energetics as well, can you say a few words?
Well, the usual role that is invoked is the restratification of the surface boundary layer. That is this positive WB that the submesoscale grows out, that implies you are making the weakly stratified surface layer more stratified. There are other roles associated with vertical scalar fluxes, forward energy cascade. The mesoscale needs energy sinks, and by quasi-geostrophic theory, it has trouble with energy sinks because of inverse cascade. There are multiple roles to be played here. Now, implicit in your question, as in many discussions that have occurred in this workshop so far, is how badly can climate models deal with this and still be okay? That's to be determined.
Jim, if you could comment or talk about how correct or incorrect you think the equations are, and how the wave field changing across the front might alter the mechanics a bit.
I'll take those as two quite separate questions. The wave current interaction theory, the waves being surface gravity waves, you know, is a long and famous one. You go back to, you know, Long and Hibbins, Higgins and Phillips and Hustleman, and they all made their contributions. There was, in some sense, an important branch point in 1976 when Craik and Leibovich wrote a theory of a particular way that waves can influence wave average currents, and it's often referred to as the Stokes vortex force, and it was among the things that I wrote up here. Since then, there have been, say, 7 to 10 papers of different asymptotic theoretical formulations trying to say what the right equations are, generalized Lagrangian mean, other approaches, and they've essentially come to convergence that something like what I wrote is the right theoretical framework as long as you can make an expansion in wave steepness. That is, you're not talking about wave breaking, but as long as in most classical theories, the wave slope is not large, then you can develop this asymptotic theory fairly robustly because the separation of timescales between surface gravity waves and these currents is so strong. An interesting event in the last year, just to pile on, was that a group of us who have derived such theories got really tired of George Mellor telling us we were wrong. And so we wrote a joint paper telling him to shut up. He, of course, didn't. But I think there's general convergence on the equations. Now, what Peter's getting at in the second question is, I've been talking about what's called WEC, wave effects on currents. Given a wave field, what's its Stokes drift, and how do the currents evolve in the presence of that Stokes drift? There's also a Q, the current effect on waves. The traditional sort of WKB ray theory approach is that the currents essentially provide a Doppler shift in the wave equation, in the wave action equation, et cetera, and the mechanism is essentially refraction, and so the currents will be different in the presence of fronts. If you talk about submesoscale fronts, and you talk about the spectrum peak waves, the ray theory tells you basically small interaction. If you start to look at short waves, the ray theory tells you it's lost, because essentially the rays go singular. You develop cusps and other such singularities. If you talk to observationalists, particularly people who fly airplanes very close to the surface under strong waves and, you know, high winds and big fronts, people like Ken Melville, they'll show you pictures of how the wave field changes near a front. Those pictures, I think, are mostly about the short waves. But it's very much an open question, and a proper theory would fully couple the two. I think we approximately have the right WEC model for that coupling. I don't think we have the right wave model yet. On the other hand, you know, good wave models are that aren't just based on empiricism of things that ignore everything I'm talking about here, you know, are kind of few and far between. But definitely a frontier problem.
So I have one synthesis question between Peter and Jim before we break, which is, so Pete, your simulations are set up to deliberately avoid horizontal heterogeneities, and you see sort of emergent coherent structures on the scale of the boundary layer, and Jim is looking at simulations that are kind of deliberately built to arrive at horizontal heterogeneities that also seem to cascade down to the scale of the boundary layer in the horizontal and produced structure. How do we know? I mean, there's a tension there that possibly the fronts that you were talking about, Pete, don't exist in the presence of the kinds of fronts that Jim is talking about. How do we sort that out?
Of course they exist. You're just talking about two different idealizations of a way to approach a certain phenomenology. You know, there's a picture of the W field with submesoscale and waves, and you see the Langmuir cell coherent structures absolutely clearly. They just aren't uniform the way they would be if you didn't have the submesoscale structure. Two different legs of the same cow.
I'm not the expert. No. The LES was specifically crafted to look at, it was a process study calculation, taking an idealized front. Really the question Jim steered the research towards was, how does arrest happen? So with a minimal amount of other debris in the problem, how does the arrest happen? That's the way that problem is couched. We never pretended that we would start from fully developed turbulence with all kinds of other physical effects and have magic happen. Problem wasn't crafted. I don't know. It's, if you pick one of the Rams fronts, the idealization, the process study in the LES was picked to mimic that.
So Kim Melvin and I are working on wave-breaking, and these are lab experiments. And so the most obvious thing to have done right now is to just basically get rid of the idea of a stationary Stokes drift. And it turns out that all of a sudden you have a very, very rich dynamic. And so all we're doing is, instead of using the assumption of averaging that you would get to get a Stokes drift, you just allow the Stokes, you calculate the Stokes drift actually strictly from the Lagrangian flow. You're actually doing the Lagrangian flow. And all of a sudden you get even yet more structure. I can't tell you what the punchline is, but it's going to even complicate things that we see here and make the interactions between waves and currents more interesting.
Will Phillips was here for 3 or 4 weeks. And he loves alternative asymptotic theories of wave-current interaction, typically choosing currents whose horizontal and vertical scales are much closer to the scales of the dominant surface gravity waves. And it's definitely a case in that sort of a problem that even without breaking, you can get different Stokes drift profiles than you do in the classical Stokes wave or Airy wave theory, which is what's being relied on here. On the other hand, most people think that Will is sort of pushing the problem away from oceanic conditions to some extent to look at the problems he is. On top of this, you can add, of course, wave breaking. And that may indeed lead to a different vertical profile of Lagrangian drift. If you average over the waves, you'll average over the breakers, you'll still get some profile. I find it hard to imagine that whatever the profile of the Stokes drift, it won't end up having effects like those in these wave average equations. And if you change the profile, well, then the effects will be a little different. But I doubt you really change the ballgame. But go ahead and try.
All right, so we have a break now until 11. And if Keith and Leif can come up and set themselves up at the beginning rather than the end of the break, that'd be great. Let's thank Jim and Pete one more time for a good start.